Hi, everyone, and welcome to the SRHM podcast. My name is Nina Sun, and I am an associate editor for the SRHM Journal. In honor of Sexual Health Day, we are pleased to share this episode on sexual pleasure. You're about to hear from four experts about the importance of pleasure for health and well-being and how it connects to family planning and contraception. They also discuss the pleasure deficit, why it exists, and what we can do about it. This episode is moderated by Anne Philpott, who's the founder and co-director of the Pleasure Project, an international education and advocacy organization working to eroticize safer sex. Anne is speaking with Ana Santos, an award-winning journalist who reports on the intersections of sexuality, sexual health, and female migrant labor. She is also a pleasure fellow at the Pleasure Project. Anne also speaks with Mahmoud Garga, lead specialist in strategic communication, media relations, and digital campaigning at the IPPF Africa Regional Office. He also leads their Treasure Your Pleasure campaign across sub-Saharan Africa. And lastly, Jessica Sanders is also joining the conversation. Jessica is an assistant professor at the University of Utah in the Division of Family Planning and Director of Research at the Ascent Center for Reproductive and Sexual Health. She received her PhD in public health from the University of Utah with an emphasis in women's health. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining the Sexual and Reproductive Health Matters podcast. I am Anne, and I'm so excited to be talking to a fabulous group of pleasure experts and pro-pleasure people today. And we are doing this because this year's World Sexual Health Day theme is Let's Talk Pleasure. And we're having this conversation in the build-up to September the 4th, which is World Sexual Health Day. And we're going to talk all things pleasure today. And so I have Ana, Mahmoud, and Jess joining from all different parts of the globe. Before we meet them, I want to tell you why I think pleasure is important and why I've dedicated so much of my life to trying to bring pleasure out of the shadows and to reduce the stigma on pleasure. And, you know, when the light bulb moment for me dawned. But for me, pleasure is an integral part of sexual health and sexuality, and yet has been, you know, sort of brushed under the carpet, thrown into a spot where it's stigmatized and made taboo. And yet the reason why pleasure is really important to me is because it's the key reason people have sex around the world. And also for me, what's important is that we need to focus on what feels good and what we want, rather than being told what we shouldn't have or what we mustn't do. And I think also what's so critical is that pleasure links so strongly to well-being and health. And there's been huge gaps in the pleasure conversation or in the amount of pleasure that different groups have been able to ask for and get. We know about the orgasm gap in terms of gender and pleasure and the differences between heterosexual women's pleasure, heterosexual men's pleasure, and lesbian and bisexual women's pleasure. You may have read about that. But also there's other gaps in terms of a pleasure hierarchy where groups whose sexual identities have been more discriminated against have been allowed less space to ask for what they want. And I think also really importantly, it's a critical part of the important conversation about decolonizing international development, decolonizing public health, because we know there are really important heritages of pleasure in many countries of the world that were colonized or that have, you know, come to recognize new religions over the last couple of centuries. And yet, if we look a bit deeper, we can see that there's a huge amount of experience of cultural practices which were about celebrating pleasure, which are about sharing knowledge on what feels good, on what good sex can look like. And then very importantly, pleasure-inclusive sexual health saves lives. The Pleasure Project did a systematic review, which we published this year. We did it with support from the Case for Her. It was an incredibly extensive review, and a systematic review is a gold standard way of looking at all of the research on a particular question over a time period. So we looked over the last 15 years and we asked the question, you know, does pleasure inclusive sexual health improve sexual health outcomes? We looked at all experimental research hoping to have an impact on sexual and reproductive health outcomes. And, you know, we reviewed over 12,000 abstracts. We did full review of 7,000 studies, and we found only 33 that had any consideration of pleasure in any form. And none of those were contraception research, which is an issue we'll come back to a bit later in this podcast. But we focused on HIV, sexually transmitted infections outcomes, and we did a meta-analysis of 8, which is a way of pooling the results across one outcome, which was condom use. And the findings were so important. The findings are that inclusive sexual and reproductive health work that's pleasure inclusive has a significant and positive impact on sexual and reproductive health outcomes. And this is the first time that there's been a systematic review on this topic. It's very important that it's with the World Health Organization. And the recommendations in that from ourselves and from the co-authors from the World Health Organizations are that we recommend agencies should consider the inclusion of pleasure in the way that they deliver their intervention. So it's really, we had a lot of interest in this systematic review, which is fantastic. It definitively shows us how pleasure is not only important because it's an integral part of our sexuality, but it also shows us that it improves sexual health outcomes. And it's striking to me that it still wasn't significantly picked up at the AIDS conference that happened a few weeks ago. We put in an abstract, we had a poster, but we weren't asked to present that. You know, this is kind of a long history of these AIDS conferences where such few abstracts mention pleasure. So, you know, in some analysis that we've done, we found that only less than 1%, 0.5% of abstracts at AIDS conferences over the last 20 years mention pleasure. And of those 0.5%, only 10% of those are positive about the pleasure. Most of them are talking about pleasure having a price. And the International Conference on Population and Development only had one abstract out of over 700 that mentioned pleasure. So today we're going to talk about this, about the importance of pleasure, but also about the pleasure deficit. Why is there that gap and what we can do about it? Why is it important that we think about asset framing in terms of flipping the narrative in how we deliver sexual and reproductive health research and programs? You know, why is it important to have a positive vision of what we're trying to aim for? And also why pleasure is important for health and well-being. But we also want to just dig a bit deeper on contraception and family planning, because this is an even larger kind of deficit, a bigger black hole in terms of the pleasure gap in sexual and reproductive health. And there's been some really great articles in SRH Matters in terms of pleasure being focused on in a trailblazing way. And there was a great article recently about the positive experience of contraception use in terms of bodily autonomy, about, you know, the conversations you can have with loved ones and body image and self-acceptance. And that's by Sophie Butcher and other authors. There was a great blog about female masturbation and cultural and historical views of it, but also the health benefits, which I hadn't known all of them. Better skin, better T cell activation and regulation of menstruation. That's by Jessica Bowe. So I recommend that people look that up. And there was also an analysis by Chris Purdy and others of the Lancet Guttmacher Commission on SRHR, in which they look at how often was pleasure mentioned. And pleasure was mentioned only 4 times, whereas reproductive health was mentioned over 200, violence nearly 100. So, you know, this pleasure deficit kind of continues, and it's been great that the journal has published so many articles to focus on it. So that's me setting the scene. But now I want to introduce you to the fabulous people that I've had the honor of being able to invite onto this podcast. And I'm going to do that by introducing them and asking them a question, which is, you know, why and when did you start thinking pleasure is important in your life? And I've got Mahmoud. here, Anna here, and Jess here. So if it's okay, I'm going to turn to you first, Mahmoud, to answer that question. And thank you joining us from Nairobi today.
Thank you very much. I'm very excited to be here. So to answer your question, I think that personally, I would say that very early on, I started thinking about pleasure. I would say as a teenager, discovering sexual pleasure alone, because until this day, I've never had sex for reproductive reasons or to have a child. So I would say that pleasure is the main reason, of course, with the feeling of intimacy and shared connections that one might experience during sex, that I have and indulge in various sexual experiences. So pleasure was important in my life early on, but there was also like an internal battle happening simultaneously in my mind. And this is due to my upbringing. I come from a household where religious values and norms were an integral part of our identities, which made pleasure a taboo topic or something that's just simply unimportant. Basically, you have sex when you're married and to have children. So there was a misalignment, maybe I can even say some type of cognitive dissonance between what I felt and believed and what I was taught by my family, educators, society. So yeah, that would be my answer to that question.
It really resonates with me, and that misalignment, I think for me, it was very similar in terms of, you know, the information I got at my all-girls school in the UK in terms of only preventing pregnancy. And then, you know, the entire sex education was focused on what happens when you're pregnant or menstruation, and then me knowing that it felt good. So why weren't people talking about that? So I think, you know, that disconnect, and why were they saying that it's something we shouldn't do? That really resonates with me. And then the gap in these AIDS conferences where everybody was acting like it's an airborne disease. I was like, this isn't making sense to me at all, you know, the biomedical approach. But yeah, that really resonates. Thank you. But now moving on to Jess, it'd be great to hear your feeling about when and why did pleasure become important to you?
Yeah, thanks for having me today. When we were thinking about these questions, I remember the first time I felt pleasure. And it's probably not the first time ever, but it was the first time I named it. And it came after a year-long depression. And I had the privilege of being introduced to meditation when I was young. I was around 16. And it was around the same time I was getting a lot of messages around risk avoidance and stigma that was associated with sex and pleasure. And at the same time, again, like you, learning about what felt good for myself and my body. And that disconnect just really resonated with me as I went through my education, as I went through relationships and experiences in my own life. And so when I came into public health and women's health, and it was so focused on these negative sexual health outcomes and the harm reduction focus, and thinking about how that varied from people's lived experience, and really wanting to recenter the patient reported outcomes in medical research and the person's lived experience, and how sexual flourishing came into that, and how pleasure related and intersected with these other kind of public health and medical experiences was really central. And then I had the great privilege of being introduced to Jenny Higgins kind of early in my career. And she had just written about the pleasure deficit in contraceptive research. And that to me, I was like, oh, yes, like this is where I want to go. And I want to incorporate this in all aspects of public health research. And so it just really clicked with me in terms of how we bring the whole person together, and felt really values aligned and with what I had experienced and where I wanted to go. So, yeah.
Oh, no, thank you. I really love your reflection on kind of being in your body and connecting to meditation. And I've heard that reflection also about how our upbringings often, or our relationships with our bodies, become disconnected also, right? And, you know, we can become very disconnected during sex, and how it's quite important in terms of pleasure to come back into our bodies, right? And feel those feelings and sensations. I think that's a great reflection. And thank you, yeah, for the mentioning of the pleasure deficit in contraception research was something that was so striking when we did this systematic review. But we'll come back to you on that.
I'm excited to talk more about it, for sure.
And then over to you, Anna. Oh, and thank you for joining us. Sorry, I was going to say where you are today. You're in Salt Lake City in Utah. Thank you for joining us early today. But now over to Anna, who's in Berlin at the moment. Berlin's not letting her go, but she has been based in Manila for a lot of her life and work. but is currently in Berlin. So over to you, Anna, on when did you start thinking pleasure was important in your life?
Hey, Annie, I'm always happy to talk about pleasure. And it's like fun that I'm here in Berlin to do it. Berlin wants to call me baby, so I'm staying. I was thinking about your question and I was thinking about the shared, I mean, there's so many similarities with what Jessica mentioned, what Mavud said. And I know Annie, you and I go back a long time. So I know also where we've had such similarities with the struggle with just, you know, saying that we like sex and we want to enjoy it when we have it. As a child, I was always reading erotic novels. I was like, I didn't know that I was masturbating to them until I think, I don't know, 20 years after. Oh, that was actually, you know, I was actually pleasuring myself. I didn't know that. I just know that I felt hot and steamy when I was reading these novels. And I felt like, you know, kind of making myself feel good physically, but I never knew what it was. And then in high school, I was that girl who wrote for my debate class. I was that girl who wrote why premarital sex, that sounds so cheap last season, right? But premarital sex was not a sin. That was my position on the position paper. And, you know, I had to talk to my teacher about it. And I remember her. I loved her. She was my English teacher. Her name is Miss Bisson. And she said, so what's your position on it? It's no, right? And I said, what do you know? I don't think it's a sin. I think sex is a normal part of a relationship and how you get to know one another. And I'll never forget how she looked at me. She's like, you're kidding, right? I said, no. She's like, oh, okay. I still remember the look of disappointment on her face. And you have to remember, I was 14 years old. This was a teacher that I loved and admired and totally respected. And so I changed my position on the paper. And I said, no, you shouldn't be having sex unless you're married, blah, 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 blah. And I think this was the theme that went on for a while, where I, in my all-girls school and in the Philippines, where it's very Catholic, very conservative, I had to think and put out there that virginity was so important and that I was not having sex because I didn't want to disappoint people who were important to me. It wasn't just the shame, right? It was also like, what are the people who are important to me? Like, is this one going to stick? And then I became a mother. So, you know, I was like, okay, the jig is out. I don't have to pretend to be a virgin anymore. But still, it was like, oh, you shouldn't be having sex. You're a mom. My whole body is supposed to be devoted to reproductive things and caring for another human. And then, you know, now that I'm in midlife, I'm now too old, supposedly, to be having sex. When am I ever going to be able to just enjoy sex? First, I was too young. Then I'm as a mother. Now I'm just supposedly too old. Now I just don't care. I want to have sex. I want to enjoy it. And I can actually like say that I like it. And I am so thankful for safe spaces like this where women like me can come out and just say that and, you know, have a soft space to land on when we actually do.
Yes, absolutely. And it's amazing that you took that position when you were 14, like, you know, to take also the positive, the sex positive position or the, you know, the position that was anti the norm, I suppose.
Yeah.
And question it.
I didn't think about it as questioning the norm or just a sex positive before. I just thought I grew up in the U.S. My early childhood days were the U.S. where it was like you lose your virginity at 16. It was supposed to be the thing, right? And here I was 14. I was like, God, I've got 2 years to go to beat this deadline. And still the whole school was just very all girl Catholic. And it was the complete opposite, you know, preserving yourself and keeping your virginity was supposed to be a mark of character and what a good person you were. And I couldn't reconcile this in my head. What are we supposed to do? Just hold hands the whole time? I don't know. And so, yeah, I thought that, but I wasn't strong enough, I guess, at 14 to stand up for myself and just risk the perception or the opinion of what someone was very important to me, what they thought of me. I wasn't strong enough to stand up for myself then.
But you kept it close to you, right? And you carried it on and, you know, you bounced back with even stronger.
Yeah, but when I shared this with someone else on another podcast, they asked me, what do you think would have changed if she had championed you then? And so I was like, I think that's why when I think of all the work that we all do in this podcast, we all deal with a lot of young people. I think about that question a lot. What if that teacher of mine had championed me when I was younger? when I was 14. And I think now I can't bring that back, but all of us here and all of us, all those people listening to this podcast and the work that we do with young people, we can be that person to champion what young people want and respect what they want. And, you know, the decision-making powers when it comes to sexuality and pleasure.
And that one person can make a big difference, right? I mean, I know there was a woman that came to our school who was the menstruation lady, but she was so free of any stigma in her discussion. It was just one person amongst all of the other negative messaging you're having can make such a big difference. So for me, that was really important as well in terms of if I think of a person that kind of motivated me to do this work. But Mahmoud, what about you and
your
work?
Yeah, I just want to say kudos to you, Anna. I mean, at age 14, if you, you know, maintain that position, and even if you change your position later due to the, you know, like the reaction of your professor, but having your peers hear what you just said and understand what you mean actually makes a big difference. It means that they're probably thinking the same thing, or it's not weird to think that, you know? So I think it did make an impact somehow.
Thanks,
yeah,
Mahmoud.
Definitely, definitely. Oh, thank you all. And thank you for sharing such personal stories as well, or personal histories. There's a kind of, you know, as I often find, a commonality in terms of most of us around the world, and listeners, this might resonate with you, have had a kind of, you know, almost universally negative experience in terms of sex education and sex shaming. And it's very rare for people to have actually had an experience where somebody said to them as a young person, well, what would you like in a relationship? What would fulfill you? What's your idea of what might be, you know, fantastic in a sexual relationship, but also in a love relationship? You know, we constantly navigate this, you know, a tightrope, or also these, this kind of darkness of needing to not talk about it, hide it, feel confused about it, feeling good, but yet people telling us it's bad. So it's a lot to carry. And I think that's what we're trying to do in terms of bringing pleasure, you know, out in the open and celebrating it.
And I love that. And I love the idea of having a safe place to like test these ideas and talk about them across the life course, right? Like, I'm also parenting right now and having these conversations with young people who are just kind of finding themselves and a lot of curiosity and trying to approach it in a loving and welcoming way. You know, I think about how I would have wanted someone to talk to me when I was young, and also, you know, knowing where I'm at postpartum and kind of moving into this midlife space and thinking about it differently and really thinking about it as like a long-term commitment to pleasure and coming back to ourselves in the middle of all these external pulls and pushes, and having that safe space to test those ideas, I think, is really essential. So I'm grateful to be in this space with you all as well and here.
Well, over to you, Jess, because like I wanted to ask next about, you know, we're talking to an audience, lots of people who have been working in sexual and reproductive health implementation and research. And I just wanted to hear from you, given your work on, you know, in contraception research, you know, where we're at the moment, what's the status quo? Like, you know, how much do we see pleasure considered in contraception research? I mean, you heard the stats from me about the review we did of the last 15 years in terms of the only pleasure, the few studies we found of them, they were focused on STI, HIV, HIV testing, HIV prevention. But I just wanted to hear from you, somebody who's been in this field for a long time, who's been studying it, and just to hear where we are at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I like to stay optimistic and that we're moving kind of in the right direction. I think that the work that has been done with kind of person-centered counseling around contraception and this really understanding that the methods that we have available to people might not be, you know, there's not one size fits all, and allowing that, again, to have that journey of where you are in your sexual lives and in your reproductive lives, and allowing those things to work in concert with one another in the healthcare system and in individuals' lived experiences, I think is really, really important. And so, you know, the work that I've done with new contraceptive development has been an interesting space, because they really, you know, I think that many folks that are working on developing new contraceptive methods understand that you know, people are not having sex to use contraception, that that people use contraception so that they can have full sexual lives. And that's something that, you know, we come back to. And I think that oftentimes is forgotten or thought of as an afterthought, right? Like, you know, we want safe and effective. And those are the things that matter most. And also the thinking that penetrative sex is this end all be all, I think has taken us away from this broader conversation and focus on prioritization of pleasure and sexual flourishing. And so one of the things that I worked on with my colleagues and my colleague Jenny Higgins, who I mentioned earlier, was creating a scale that could be incorporated into contraceptive development that included things like pleasure and orgasm quality and orgasm frequency and that exchange of pleasure between partners, as well as the physical arousal and functioning and the psychological emotional connection and surrendering pieces. Because we know that with contraception, oftentimes the mechanical impacts may either be imperceptible or even have some kind of acceptable negative pieces, but that the ability to surrender and let go are a wonderful tool for people in living their fullest sexual lives. And so, you know, my hope is that we can incorporate that scale as we develop new contraceptive methods, but really just that framing around pleasure being as important as safety and efficacy in how we approach contraceptive development and how we talk about contraception in clinical settings. So, you know, making sure that when someone comes into a clinical setting and says, you know, like my libido feels different, I'm noticing some differences, that instead of having a provider dismiss that comment, that it's an invitation for a conversation about, you know, what does that look like? And is this something that you think you can work through? Or do we want to try something else? Do we want to bring it, you know, try a different method? Or do we want to have a different conversation? And remembering that contraception is not a one-stop shop, right? There's different options for different people, and being able to switch and discontinue is an important part of that type of care to make sure that people are able to use it as a tool in pursuit of their...
It's brilliant that you've developed this scale, right? And that's fantastic. And it was so, like I say, so striking to me that you didn't find any contraception research that actually looked at issues like libido, right? And, but how often do you think research now with new innovations actually considers pleasure, if you're looking at kind of across the horizon of new research?
I still think it's few and far between, and I want to continue to promote it. I think, so we received a grant from the National Institutes of Health, and being able to be a part of a larger group that was focused on new contraceptive development. And so annually we go and talk to these contraceptive developers to say, you know, here are the ways that you can kind of incorporate user experience and incorporate pleasure into the work that you're doing. So I think that the conversations are happening, and hopefully as we move forward, that becomes a norm, is something I would like to see. Because I also think one of the things that we've seen in our qualitative research is that not being able to have the sex lives that people want is an absolute deal breaker. Like, you know, on the demand side, like that is something that if people can't achieve that, they're done with that method. And so when contraceptive developers and marketers think about that space, like that should be enough to really say, okay, let's up our commitment, our prioritization.
Well, I know that at the International Conference on Family Planning, which is happening again in November, it's the first time there's a pleasure track. There's going to be a panel all about pleasure at that. So that's fantastic. And yeah, I mean, I really hope, like you say, that it starts to become the norm. And like, you know, my hope is that we reach the day when sexual health research or sex education that doesn't include pleasure is seen as poor quality, or that somebody might turn around to us pleasure experts and say, you mean there was a time when pleasure wasn't seen as a critical component of sexual health? How bizarre is that? You know, I'm hoping that's like in 10 years time, because, you know, that's what it feels like to me. How can you not include pleasure in research around contraception, which is, you know, a kind of tool, as you say, to be able to have the sex that you want? And, you know, with that, I was going to move over to you, Anna, and just your experience of talking to women in the Philippines about their sex lives and the kind of programs or the research you might have done with them to find out about why they wanted access to sexual health or contraception, how pleasure came up, and, you know, what your views are on this kind of gap in the discussion or the stigma around pleasure.
When we talk about, you know, and when you ask me questions about the gap in, you know, contraception gap and all of that in the Philippines, automatically questions or answers like how many women want contraception but can't access it, you know, or how many women can't afford it, and therefore how many children do they have versus how many children do they actually want to have? These are kind of gaps that we talk about. But I remember so well one time when I did a story about there was a massive stock out of birth control in the Philippines, and I couldn't find my birth control in the drugstore, and I was very upset. And then I decided to do a story, as most journalists will do when they're upset about something, they'll do a story about it. And I went to the grassroots communities to talk to the women there. We were gathered around, you know, one Saturday afternoon, and I asked them, how do you feel about this stock outage of contraception? You can't find your birth control. How do you feel? And they were giving me a lot of, like, you know, developmental answers. I'll have more children than I want. It's really nice to be able to just plan how many children you can have. And we're already poor, so we can't afford to have more children. And then, you know, I was thinking about, okay, what is this going to look like in a story? So put away the notebook. I bought some soft drinks and some crackers and crisps for all of us. And I said, okay, girlfriend, come on. I'm going to put away the notebook. Let's talk. You're giving me answers that are coming from here. And I pointed to their head and I said, but I want to ask you, what does having birth control mean for you here? And I pointed to their heart and I said, and down here, you know, and I pointed to their genitalia. And all of us, they started giggling and laughing. And I think the soft drinks and crackers helped, but they started opening up. And I will never forget one woman said, if I didn't have birth control, okay, I would be like, there would be one baby sucking at my breast for milk, and then I would have a baby in my stomach, and then I would have a baby pulling at my skirt. When my husband comes home, he's going to want to have a part of me. He's going to want to have access to my vagina. What part of me is left for me? And then this other girl said, I love this so much. She said, you know, when I have birth control and I know that I'm not going to get pregnant unnecessarily, she's like, I can ask for it because, hey, it can't just be about him, right? And to me, it was like, this is the kind of empowerment that these women, you know, resources are difficult in their settings, but this is a kind of place where they can have empowerment. And just what you were saying exactly about surrender, you know, what the kind of pleasure that birth control can give you when it comes to surrender and just knowing that I can enjoy this moment and not have to worry what's going to happen to me after this. And I may be strapped with a new responsibility for the next 18 years, you know.
And that's the bit that, you know, to use a British expression, really does my head in when I go to kind of, you know, health conferences or see the, you know, the research that we've just looked all across the last 15 years, all of the SRHR research, right? That there's now such a benefit to having the conversation from this perspective of pleasure. And how can we continue with these narratives which are fear and disease based? You know, you look through the SDGs, there's really nothing that focuses on pleasure, a bit on well-being, but maybe not related to sexual well-being or sexual flourishing, and how this continues to be disaggregated by the public health and the kind of, you know, the biomedical focus, what it's done to our work on sexuality and sexual health. And we now know that this is such an important intervention. And it's not an intervention that requires a big new health infrastructure or a product. It's a changing of the conversation. It's about flipping the narrative. And that's it. And, you know, it's going to take some people holding a mirror up to themselves and relearning how to have the conversation and get comfortable with their own sexuality as well. But I've just always, you know, been struck by these presentations I've seen in the public health world where it's almost surprising to people that pleasure is important. I remember going along to a research conference about, you know, new vaginal microbicides, which were being developed to help prevent HIV. And they were like, you know, had this lovely consistency, this one that it was going to be delivered in. Basically, you know, you inserted it into your vagina. It provided a kind of nice, slippery sort of film inside your vagina could potentially prevent HIV. And then the researchers are like, oh, but the women kept wanting more of it and they kept using loads of it and using it on the days they weren't meant to. And I'm like, that's because it's like lube and lube is brilliant. And like, when did you not realize, you know? And I just like, I can't believe that people sort of also divorce their personal sexuality and sexual experiences from their work as a professional and what that's about, like why they can't relate that experience they might have to enjoying lube or enjoying the sensation to their work as a researcher or a sex educator. And I guess I'm starting to get more and more frustrated now that we definitively know that pleasure inclusive sexual health improves, you know, increases condom use. There is literally no excuse for, you know, any of the, you know, the lack of funding in this area now, the billions of dollars that are spent every year on HIV prevention to still skip this important intervention, you know, and focus on, you know, there's been a lot of innovation in HIV prevention research in sexual health work, and that's been amazing. There's been a lot of responding to what communities have said about what they need, but to still have this pleasure gap when it will improve condom use and sexual health outcomes, there is literally no excuse for it any longer. But before I start going off on an even longer rant, I'm going to come over to Mahmoud and just, you know, from your perspective on, you know, and all your amazing experience in comms and how you've seen communication campaigns work, why you think there's still this huge pleasure gap in terms of SRHR and contraception.
Thanks, Anne. So as you know, I've worked in communications my entire career. So my answer will come from a communication standpoint. I'm used to designing campaigns, crafting and testing messages, see how they resonate with different audiences, etc. When it comes to family planning and contraception information, I think that the way that we communicate about these issues, just like any other topic, changes and evolves over time. You know, like audiences change, social norms that are considered acceptable in society, they also change. Let's not forget about taboos. You know, what used to be taboo 60 years ago might not be today. So I'm pretty sure that our grandparents, like when they communicated about family planning and contraception, they didn't communicate in the same way that we do today. They're probably designing their messages and communications for a specific audience. You know, let's say married couples, for example. Today, it is clear that we communicate differently. And perhaps the traditional, in my opinion, I think the fear-based communication around sexual reproductive health, you know, that we're so used to, such as contracting a sexually transmitted disease or, sorry, infection or an unwanted pregnancy, may have been overplayed over the years. So introducing a new narrative shift towards a more sex-positive communication style, which would include a pleasure-based approach, is kind of refreshing, innovative, appealing. It attracts people's interest. I think it's the inevitable evolution of communication around sexual and reproductive health, in a sense where it's like a completely different way to approach the issue.
And I think there's been a lot that, you know, I've seen from the world of communications and maybe the world of condom sales originally that actually flipped the narrative to think in a more positive way. And I think that's, you know, because there's had to be a focus on uptake, right? You know, and, you know, so it has been refreshing to see more sex positive communications from that world. But it's this careful navigation, isn't it, of sex positive and pleasure based sexual health against what the media can do or comms can do with this hypersexualization, right? So navigating this new world of pleasure based sexual health. But now I'm going to come, before we round off, I don't want to end this conversation. I love talking to you all, but I'm just going to kind of close with a look to what we can really do about this now. How can we address this gap? You know, how do we reduce this stigma? And before I turn to you all, I mean, you know, I do think things are changing. You know, I set up the Pleasure Project 18 years ago, really in a sort of state of frustration and ranting. And I think, you know, I've seen a massive change over the last few years in terms of a real kind of pleasure wave, as I like to call it, a pleasure moment. And I think there's like, you know, beginning to be a recognition in the sexual and reproductive health world about how important it is. And, you know, some markers of that are the World Association of Sexual Health, it's their Sexual Pleasure Declaration, which got ratified last year. This, you know, World Sexual Health Day this year is Let's Talk Pleasure, and they're spearheading that. Alongside that declaration, they've put out a brilliant technical guide, which kind of pulls together all the research on gender and pleasure, why sex is good for you, which is really fascinating. you know, why it's important to integrate pleasure in healthcare. And, you know, that's been really, really exciting. And, you know, from our perspective, from the Pleasure Project's perspective, we've put out these pleasure principles, which accompany the pleasure declaration. And we've got, you know, more than 15 organizations who have endorsed them now, which is really exciting. And they're taking really concrete action to implement pleasure-based sexual health. So we're starting to get brilliant examples of best practice of what organizations are doing, including the International Planned Parenthood Federation, your organization, Lafmood, which is brilliant because they're the world's largest deliverer of reproductive health services. So this is really significant, this change in the way that actual services are being delivered. And I think that's the piece that's really important to me. You know, the research is important, the policy frameworks are important, but the actual delivery. And I'd love to hear from you all about, you know, what more we can do, what you've been doing, and, you know, how we can really, you know, also inspire listeners to think about what they might be able to do, how they might be able to endorse the principles themselves and implement pleasure-based sexual health. But if it's okay, Mahmoud, because I just mentioned IPPF, I could come to you first.
Yes, of course. It's my pleasure. So at the International Planned Parenthood Federation, we've always believed that pleasure is fundamental to your well-being. We also think and believe that comprehensive sexual education on a global level needs to be drastically improved. It needs to step away from a fear-based framing to one rooted in sexual health and orientation and gender identity in a holistic manner. So at the African region, we're trying to develop a more pleasure-based approach, which envisions, you know, good sex built on sexual rights and celebrates the joy and well-being we feel when we can freely and safely explore the contours of our desires and our sexuality. This year, we started a campaign. We launched a campaign called Treasure Your Pleasure, and you can visit our landing page at treasure-your-pleasure.com, where we wanted to reach young people where they are, mainly in digital spaces, and spark a conversation on sexual pleasure and the many forms it may take. The campaign messaging focuses on empowering audiences to think and discuss sexual pleasure, regardless of their sexual orientation, gender identity, and or expression, or their any disabilities and experiences. And the message are always, always, always sex positive and rights based. Our campaign landing page includes links to additional resources. Some of them are from the Pleasure Project, others are from IPPF, and a variety of pleasure-based documents that anyone can access and download for free. We also made sure, because this campaign is aimed at sparking this conversation around with young people, we also made sure to make this landing page as interactive as possible. So we devised a quiz, for example, on how do you travel your pleasure journey, which is very interesting and quite surprising. You might surprise yourself if you do take the quiz. We developed downloadable stickers for social media, a social media frame for your photo, for your profile photo, for example. So we really want young people to come on the site, stay as long as possible, have fun while they're doing it, and also learn from trusted and trustworthy and trusted resources. We also think that this campaign is not just relevant for the Africa region. I think what we're trying to do is to take the learnings from this campaign and then adapt it to other regions. I just want to give you an example. A few weeks ago, we accidentally forgot to like target or do the geographic coverage for our Facebook boosting on our campaign content. And then Facebook just automatically sent the content to Asia. And then we immediately saw a huge spike in traffic on that landing page coming from India, Bangladesh, Vietnam, Cambodia. And we're like, oh, this is strange. Why is this happening? Then we realized that we forgot to do the geographic coverage or limitations. So 2 weeks later, we did the same experiment and we saw that Asian audiences are also very interested in the content in the campaign. So which means that even if this campaign was designed and, you know, was intended for African audiences, Asian audiences are also very interested in this content. So I think it's more of a universal kind of content that everybody would, you know, enjoy consuming and seeing and looking at and learning more. So yeah,
brilliant.
That's about it. Yeah.
And listeners should check out the Treasure Your Pleasure campaign. I think it's brilliant. And, you know, everybody should do the quiz as well. And yeah. You know, we're presenting, and you're back, we'll be presenting it at the International Conference on Family Planning in November. And so, yeah, great to hear more about it. But just coming over to you, Jess, you know, talking about, you know, Mahmoud's talked about how IPPF has actually delivered a pleasure inclusive intervention that's bringing in more young people, like is going beyond the geographical reach they thought. And I think having a huge influence on the organization as a whole and other organizations to actually know how to do this. I think often people say, oh, we can see that it's important, but we don't know how, what steps we're going to take. And that's why we wrote the pleasure principles, like as a kind of inspirational guide and friend to actually taking those steps to changing the conversation. So just coming to you, Jess, like in terms of if you could wave a magic wand and, you know, have an influence over all the contraception research that's going to happen over the next decade, you know, what would that wand do? And what do you think we can do?
Well, first, I would hope that all of the folks who are doing the research and who are providing the healthcare go and take their own pleasure journey quiz, because I think that remembering, you know, kind of what your personal experience is and bringing that into the spaces that you inhabit can do a huge amount of good in bringing the person back. And I think that, you know, we've spent a lot of time in public health talking about health equity and thinking of more and more about sexual health and wellness equity, you know, that making sure that we better understand the relationships between socioeconomics and resources and sexual flourishing and opportunities to really improve people's lived experiences, both in the small conversations that we have, as well as these larger kind of research that, you know, can span populations. And I think that supporting additional work with mixed methods and qualitative work of, you know, hearing people's lived experiences is a central component to that, as they're, you know, both developing new methods to better meet people's changing needs and having those messages and how they're incorporated back into the healthcare systems and reap and prioritizing that. I love Mahmoud's comment about the evolution of communication. And I think certainly for health communication and how we interact at the clinical level and the research level, we, you know, I think those shifts are important to embrace, and that progress is important to embrace and bring back that sexual wellness. That would be my wish, right? That it's conversations that happen early and often and in a variety of settings, both at the research and the clinical interaction level.
And even more around designing contraception that would enhance your sex life, right?
And yeah, and meet all of the varied needs of people's lived experience so that they can experience sexual pleasure and they can just experience the pleasure of being in their body and being able to attend and attenuate to those experiences and kind of alleviating these other concerns that often detract from our sexual experiences and our ability to kind of experience pleasure in this body. So
yeah. And I mean, I'd love to see that as an aim in research and programs, right? That being the goal, to enhance the sexuality experience, right? And because there's this weird artificial split between the products that are sold for health gain and the products that are sold as sex toys, right? And, you know, never the twain shall meet, right? But how brilliant would it be if there was much more building bridges between those worlds and seeing the, you know, the, I mean, I've seen so many adverts recently, maybe it's my like Facebook algorithms and my age and so on, about products for menopausal women that are focused on reducing discomfort, like vaginal drying or, you know, and so many of them look to me like they could be also promoted as sex toys, right? Like how come they're just promoted as a medical product, you know? And the same with condom, you know, when I was working in condom promotion and particularly the internal condom, I used to talk about it as a potential sex toy. Right. You know, the rub on the clitoris or the lube that's already part of the condom and how it could be inserted in advance. Mahmoud, you've got a sexy condom tip you're going to add.
Actually, no. Your last comment made me think about those vintage ads that we used to see, I think, in the 50s. There were obviously like, you know, sex toys that were marketed as like neck massager, you know, or something like that. It is so obvious. But again, it's the way we communicate around these things, you know, and how they evolve. And that's so interesting. So,
I mean, yeah, some of it, I suppose, is the way you get it, you know, the way you market it because you have to because of censorship. But, you know, when you don't have to, we don't have to have those artificial boundaries.
But I think that brings it back to this like decolonizing and decentralizing health and wellness and bringing it back to the individuals, right? Like that's a big part of what you're talking about and what we're all talking about.
And I think that addition to that, it's also destigmatizing, you know, it's, I think for the average, let's say, movable middle person, buying something that has some kind of medical connotation and use it as a sex toy sounds better than actually walking into a sex store, buying something, you know, that is labeled sex toy. You see what I mean? I think it's our internal blockages, maybe. That's what I think. I don't know if you agree on that.
And yeah, I won't be able to do this on the podcast, but, you know, we're very fond at the Pleasure Project of doing condom demonstrations of sex toys and, you know, showing how you can add a bit of lube in the end of the male condom and the way that, you know, you can roll it down the penis really slowly and that can feel good. And, you know, because I think, you know, we talk about, I don't know, like sexy underwear or stockings or latex dresses or, and then when you see, you know, adverts for so many things like toothpaste or cars, they're kind of sexied up. But, you know, when it comes to condoms or whatever, it's sold as like a medical device that's going to prevent disease. That is not the bit of people's brains that are fired up when they're thinking about getting sexy. So, you know, and my equivalent is, I think, God, would you sell toothpaste showing somebody's mouth with all kind of, you know, decay and teeth falling out? No, you show the sexy, like, you know, the person with the beaming smile and the great teeth and, you know, so. It's like, why we're not learning that lesson in SRHR? Just again, I'm kind of a bit lost as to why not, but I think that's where we can learn lots from other fields. But over to you, Anna Ron, what else can we do about this? What can we do to get rid of this gap? And, you know, and in journalism, have you seen better reporting on pleasure?
Well, I think that, you know, pleasure is having a moment. I see a lot of reports of women in the places that you wouldn't expect, you know, advocating for their pleasure and saying that it's their right. So you have Arab women talking about it. You have young women also talking about it. And I love that there's also a diversity in the way that we're talking about pleasure. Pleasure and disability, for example. One of our pleasure fellows, Damien, is an advocate of pleasure and disability. I love it. Because for a long time, it was always that pleasure belonged to only certain people or could be experienced by only certain people, the beautiful, the able-bodied, the young. And, you know, at some point, we're not going to be all of those things. But, you know, we're always going to want to have some kind of joy with our body. And so while I think that pleasure is having a moment, and there is this like the dam has been broken and so many, you know, yeah, I love it. But at the same time, we also have to be very aware that global movements like the overturn of Roe versus Wade, which is a very influential place, the US, is going to influence also the discussions and the movements and the laws and the policies that regulate the norm that we just somehow find ourselves being oppressed by. This is going to have a huge impact. And it's not going to be the last thing that we're going to have to worry about. You know, Roe versus Wade is not going to be the last thing. Basically, they rolled out a roadmap of what else they want to reverse for us, right? So I think that what we really have to do now as pleasure advocates is to, we've moved the goalposts. We're not giving up the position we have now. I think that has to be very clear and protecting the advances that we've made in the different markets that we've had. For me, it's right now, I've learned that my relationship with sex and my own sexuality has changed so much over time, and it's dictated by my life stage. So I'm going to like grow middle me and give Filipino women specifically, you know, a space where we can talk about sex in middle age. I'm telling you, sex in middle age, it looks a lot like puberty. Except you don't have pimples anymore, you know? But it's all of a sudden you're like, okay, what is this? I don't know how to have sex anymore. If you've come out of a long relationship and it's ended, or maybe you've come out of a sabbatical, sexual sabbatical, who knows? But I just know that for a lot of women my age, like, whoa, this feels like puberty again. What is it? So, you know, let's walk each other through it. And I think that's what we can all do as pleasure advocates. Let's walk each other through it, but know that the advances that we've made, the milestones, the orgasmic moments in pleasure advocacy, we got to keep on holding on to that and pushing it forward.
Absolutely. No, and I love the way you talk about the kind of untold story of sexuality in middle age as well, and through the life course, and, you know, how that's something which is, you know, we need to flip the narrative on as well, right? Oh, it's been such an amazing, wonderful conversation. I don't want it to end. It's so, I always, my heart swells when I have these conversations with pleasure champions and pro pleasure people who I personally think are the best people to talk to and work with. And it's great that the pleasure community is growing and growing. I hope that listeners will, you know, look at the resources that come with this podcast, will, you know, consider endorsing the pleasure principles, thinking about pleasure in their work, you know, seeing the great work that, you know, everybody on this call has been doing. It's been so wonderful to have a call where we've talked also about our personal journeys, because I think that's one of the big barriers as well in the SRHR world, is that people need to also, you know, love themselves and love their own sexuality and really consider how they think about the work that they're doing against this backdrop, which is this learned backdrop of a kind of biomedical and, you know, this historical way that reproductive and sexual health has been implemented, which is about fertility control or disease control. And, you know, I really hope that we will get to a day when we actually sit down and start designing research or a program or start a conversation by thinking, what are we hoping to change in that person's life? What well-being are we wanting to enhance, rather than the conversation having a full stop when a disease is stopped, right? We really, really are ultimately aiming for more good, safe sex in the world, more sexual flourishing, as you called it, Jess, more enhancement of well-being. And I think that, you know, is something that I'd really should be centered in our development programs, in our health work, and really, you know, links to well-being, to asset framing, and moving away from what we've become used to as professionals and people, both in our own sex education, but also in our professional training, which is about, you know, reducing the people we're working with and ourselves to these components of just disease prevention or stopping violence or whatever it is, whatever the kind of aim is. We really need to look beyond those and raise our eyes to what we really want in the world and move beyond this. And I think pleasure is a key to that, you know. And as you said, Anna, you know, like, once you've found your pleasure, it's going to be hard to personally roll it back. And I'm hoping that we can see that with the pleasure wave as well. You know, once you've got access to contraception and therefore know what it's like to have risk-free sex, you know, it's historically what we've seen is that people will not give that up easily, you know. And I, with pleasure as well, once you've been, you know, able to have that kind of shame-free access and that rights-based access, it's going to be hard for people to push and roll that back. And I think what you showed us also, Mahmoud, about the Treasure Your Pleasure campaign and how such a huge, amazing response to that from young people in Africa, and how they've responded so positively to what is really a kind of honest conversation, a pleasure-based conversation. It's going to be difficult for agencies to deliver the same type of sex education. So what a fabulous conversation. Thank you all. I know I could carry on talking for hours, so I'm going to have to shut myself up now. But thank you so much for coming on this podcast. And listeners will be able to see the links to their resources when this goes out and learn more about Anna, Mahmoud and Jess's work. So please do look that up. And thank you for listening.
Thank you to Anne Philpott, Anna Santos, Mahmoud Garga, and Jessica Sanders for this insightful conversation. Please see the episode description for links to the resources mentioned by the speakers. Thank you for supporting the podcast, which is produced by SRHM. The music was composed by Thibert Christian and Salomon Beautonde.